This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2019, held at Faith Builders from July 29 through August 2.
All right, well, I think we'll get started. So welcome to this breakout as we think about the topic of classroom accommodations. Come on in. Some handouts right there. So I teach third grade at Shalom Mennonite School in Lancaster. Maybe I should just wait a little bit. Come on in. You can grab some handouts right there. So I teach at Shalom Mennonite School in Lancaster. I have third grade, so I have a homeroom classroom there. And I just love teaching. I love the opportunity to interact with my students. And God has given me a specific passion for helping the students that struggle, the students that find school difficult, and for walking alongside of them, especially the slow learners. And I love learning as well. And I kind of think of, as teachers, we should be students of our students. We are studying them. Who are they? What are they thinking? How are they learning? How can I best teach them? And I just feel like I'm constantly learning new things about how to work with my students and to help them to best learn. And I wasn't into teaching long until I got these different needs in my classroom that I saw, and I wanted to learn more about how do I help these students. And so that was kind of the path that I went then as I took some college classes and worked on just learning more about these needs. And I wanted a broader knowledge of the specific learning needs that our students are facing and how to work with them. And so we have a diverse group of students in our classrooms. And I kind of think of it like my shape sorter here. So each of these shapes is kind of representing a different student. Each one of them has different strengths, different weaknesses. They have different backgrounds. They have different stories and needs. And I cannot try to fit this student into this hole or this one or this one. I cannot. And I can try hard to make them who they're not, but I can't force them. And so to figure out how to work with all of these different needs so that they are successful, that they're able to learn. And it's challenging to do that because we can't meet all of the needs. And I think we'll talk about that some today. And just we can't, sometimes we see all these needs and we can't get around to all of them. And so it's a challenge. I want to recognize that. And I just feel like we cannot expect our students to be one size fits all. We can't expect to be able to do it one way and it works for all of them as much as we would like to sometimes. So as teachers, there's common problems or common challenges that we are facing. Could you just pop out to me, what are some, like a specific, if you can put words to it, just a specific challenge that you have faced in your classroom or that you envision that you will face down the road? Could you just give me some of your ideas?
I struggle with, because my children are from different language backgrounds, that they can struggle with reading comprehension. Mm-hmm. And just understand what you mean.
Yes. Mm-hmm. What else?
Short attention spans.
Mm-hmm. Where we can't focus and we're very distracted by other people and other things. Good. Anything else you're thinking of?
One thing that I faced was when a student seems to have missed some very foundational concepts, which was 8.5 or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And to know how
you're working with that later on.
Yes, later. Right. I think that especially comes in play in older grades when there's these gaps, and it's how do we reach those? Yeah. I think So when I'm thinking of different types of needs, I kind of categorize them in my mind as we have behavioral needs, things like focus and even like autism and communication things, and then we have the academic side of things like reading fluency and reading comprehension and math comprehension and those things. So that's kind of how I would categorize them. And so what are classroom accommodations? So let's just talk about this. Accommodations are something the teacher does differently to ensure that a student does not end up failing due to difficulties created by an inherited condition over which the student has not control. Now that's kind of like pretty wordy, but basically I would like to focus in on the part where which the student has not control, when they're not able to fix it on their own, or they're not, so it's difficult to discern. I think this is one of the biggest challenges is to discern if this child, if the problem is that they are not trying hard enough, or if they actually are not capable of it. And sometimes they do have attitude issues. I just don't feel like doing it. I don't feel like working too hard today. But there are times where the student can't fix it by trying harder. And like for example, a student can't not control if they were born with dyslexia. That is a inherited condition. They cannot control if they have experienced trauma or hard things in their life. And even this isn't about ADHD per se, but when a student truly has ADHD, they have a chemical imbalance in their brain, and that is impacting how they're able to function in the classroom. And so those things they cannot change, and we need to figure out how to work with them, how to support them and enable them to move forward. And a big piece of that is learning to know our students, learning to know what their needs are. We need to study them, like I said, and it takes a lot of wisdom to know, is, like I had said, is this something that I can push them harder, they just need to work harder, or is it a bigger problem than that? Whenever things are not going well in our classrooms, I think it's important. I heard the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting different results. So we can keep doing the same thing over and over and hope that it's going to get better. And sometimes we need ideas for what to do. What can we try a little different here to shift it, to make it more feasible for them? So I think that we need to be supporting our students. But I also feel like we have to keep in front of us that accommodations can actually be dangerous. So I was kind of, this topic feels a little tricky to me because yes, we want to support our students. Yes, we want to help them to succeed. But we have to be careful that we're not accommodating them too much, that it's actually hindering them. Let me see if I can explain that a little bit. So I think of accommodations, I think of this analogy. It's not perfect, but it helps me to think about this. Accommodations is to tutoring as crutches are to a cast. So the accommodations are like the crutches. They are intended to be a support for a season, but we're not going to keep them forever. We want to get rid of them as soon as we can. And you want your students to become as independently functioning as possible. And so when we are supporting, we just cannot, like we always are moving them forward and backing off the accommodations as soon as we can. So the goal is to make it, the goal is not to make it super easy for them so that they can just fly by and get good grades. That's not our goal. The goal is to make it doable for them so that they're not in this downward negative spiral of like, I just can't do it, I can't do it. Accommodations are kind of to give them a little boost so that they can get in like a positive cycle so that they are able to just feel like this is possible. And then when you get them in that positive cycle, then they're able to move forward. So these crutches, these accommodations are not, you don't use them, you don't have to use crutches without a cast. usually. So the cast is like the tutoring, the part that's getting to the root of the problem, sometimes accommodations can kind of help them to get by, and it is important that we get to the root of the problem with tutoring, if that is an option. I understand sometimes that it's not, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But that's what's needed for real success, rather than just covering over and helping them get by. When at all possible, we can do that. And again, that's supported by the crutches. So let's just think about, that's the role of accommodations, is the supporting piece, but we want to get rid of them when we can. So as I think about working with students, I'm always thinking about taking them from where they are to where I want them to be. And there's this theory called the zone of proximal development, which is by Lev Vygotsky, and I kind of drew it up here as well. It's taking students from what is known to what is they don't know, or what they're able to do to what they're not able to do yet. And there's this big gap here in the middle. And our job as teachers is to give them steps to help them get to here. This is far enough apart that they're not able to get over here on their own. Okay? So in here is the scaffolding, is this term. That's the support that we give our students to help them get across this zone. So some students don't need much scaffolding at all, and no matter how you teach it, they're gonna get over there to where they need to be. But some students, it looks different for different students in what steps do they need to get there. And some students need more support in this section than others. And so that's just kind of the big picture, I think, of what our job, to take them from here to here. And then the question is, how do we get them there? What do we do when it's not working? When the steps we are trying are not successfully helping them across the gap. So, why do we accommodate our students? It's a part of the scaffolding. It's that pick them across, like we were talking about. And it's an acknowledgement of the diversity of our students and their uniqueness. And sometimes input, like what we think we are giving our students, is not the same, is not equal to what they're actually receiving. So sometimes there's factors that are in the way. Like maybe a prior experience. So sometimes our communication is not completely getting carried through, or there's factors in the way, like a language difficulty, like you had mentioned, might be hindering their progress to the other side, or some sensory or motor difficulties, or a learning disability, or trauma that they've experienced might be standing in the way. So we need to figure out how to get around that, how to help them move beyond that. And so I think it's important for us to remember that sometimes input does not equal the intake or what they're actually receiving. Does that make sense? Okay. A big question about this is it fair? Is it fair to not expect the exact same thing from everyone? It's a tough question. It's something that we need to think about. And fairness or sameness is treating them all exactly the same, no matter what. They all have the exact same expectations. Justice is giving each one what he needs that's going to actually help them. So I like this picture a lot. And I've seen this different ways, but you can think of this line. Oops. This line here is like the line of success. Or I've seen it before as there's a fence, and these children are trying to look over the fence to see the exciting things on the other side. And over here, another way to put it is equality versus equity. Here, we give them all the same thing. High standards. This one is very successful, this one is barely making it, and this one is not successful. Over here, we give them all the high standards, But these two get great teaching as well, and this one gets individual support, and they're all able to be successful. So I feel like it's more fair to give them what they are needing rather than expecting them all to be exactly, giving them exactly the same thing. Do you have thoughts on that or pushback? It's just helped me to think about why am I supporting them, how am I supporting them, and what's the reason that I'm doing it. So when do we do this? We want to not have to do accommodations if we don't have to. We want to keep it as normal as possible if we can. But sometimes with our students' needs, there's no way that we can expect them to do the same thing as everyone else. So when a student is experiencing repeated failures, so if they fail a test one time, we're not going to start accommodating them right away. It needs to be something that is a repeated problem. And also, like with the crutches and the cast, we want to use it in addition to tutoring, not in place of that. So, how do we do this? In our classrooms, it's important. We want to have a high standard of academic excellence in our classes. When a student is not able to reach the bar that we have set, our goal, or the way I think about it, is that I'm going to lower this bar for them so that they can like get a taste of success, and then they're able to gradually pull the bar up. And then that is what's calling them back to independence and to being doing it the same as everyone else. We also want to think about aligning the accommodations with the difficulty that the child is experiencing. So if a child is struggling with comprehension, you're not going to give him a timer to get his work done faster. Like, those two things don't connect. Okay? Or if a child has anxiety over his test, and that's a problem that's not helping him, he's not able to be successful in his test because he's stressed about it, we're not going to put on a time strain on him because that's going to make it worse. Like, we want to think about what's the problem here and what accommodation aligns with that. Sometimes we don't always know. We have to be problem solvers and experiment because sometimes we don't know what the problem is. Sometimes children have multiple things going on and it's hard to know which one. So, for example, if a child is struggling with learning to read and they have difficulty focusing, it is hard to know what's the actual problem. Are they not learning to read because they're not paying attention and they're not like with me? Or are they not learning, or is it actually a learning problem? Like dyslexia or some kind of other disability. And as we think about implementing these changes and help support for our students, it's important to think about the student too and their perspective and how they are taking this. So we want to do it as privately as possible as if we can. So we don't want the whole class to know that this student has a different expectation than the rest of us. So sometimes I will just whisper with my student or communicate with them at a private level versus everybody knowing that they have a different test or that they don't have the writing cursive but everyone else does. Or to kind of just, we don't want the student to suddenly be looked down upon. You have to know your class culture, your classroom, like the vibes that you get from other students in there. And be gracious and sensitive to their feelings and how they are responding. So I know, especially as students are getting older, it becomes a bigger challenge, I think. I was talking with a teacher who was trying to accommodate her sixth grade students so he was having difficulty like with writing and copying things. And so out of the textbook and the math book, they have to like copy all the problems over. And she was making copies of the math page for him so that he could just write on the page instead of having to make all the copies, which seemed like a brilliant thing to do to help him. However, he did not like it at all because he felt like he was being singled out and he felt like she thought he was stupid and that he can't do it. And so her frustration was, I'm trying to help him and he doesn't want it. And if that's the case, we don't want to make the problem worse. And we really need to think about the student's perspective. And if our attempts are making it worse, we should stop them. And maybe try something else. Just be careful with those kinds of things. Some students are definitely more sensitive to that than others. And I think we can also build a culture in our classrooms of acceptance that we're all different, and understanding each other in that way. I mean, in our churches we are all different, in our communities, and just getting used to that idea, not tearing people down for being different than us, and just helping our students to think about that. The chart that I showed with the people and getting different things, I have actually explained that to my students and showed them that picture about, and I like did it in a child-friendly way, as it was like a fence that we all want to be able to see over the top of it. And it's okay if some of us get different things. Like, for example, I need glasses to see, otherwise I'm like blind, and you don't. So we are different in that way. We have different supports. Some children need braces, some of them do not. And like those are very common differences among us. And so just to help them have that mindset is important. Along these lines, I also think of labels, and there's like labeling a child can be a positive thing and it can be a negative thing. So again, it really depends on a situation. A label's like saying they have autism, or they have experienced trauma, or they have dyslexia. Labels can be helpful in that they can be freeing for a child. Like, oh, that's why this is so hard for me. It's not just that I'm weird. There's actually something that's different about me, and that's why it's so hard. So it can be freeing. Maybe that's when they get older. That could be the way. I'm not sure. Well, but it also can be like the other side of it is that it can make people like, I have this problem, so I'm just not going to try, and that's my excuse. So again, just to think through those things and be careful with how we approach them. Another thing I just want to throw out there, when we talk about students with learning needs, we want to use person-first terminology, which means like instead of saying the dyslexic child, they are a child with dyslexia. Or instead of calling them the ADHD child, they are a child with ADHD. Or a child with trauma. Or a child with, I can't think of, a child with autism. Instead of that saying like they are a child, they are a person. It's just a slight thing, but it can change the feel of how we are viewing them. They're a child first with something different or something that's coming along with it, but I just don't like when we say we put the adjective in the front. Say this is the dyslexic child or the, yeah. Just something to think about there. So with how to do this, again, only as long as necessary. Now, sometimes I've worked with students where they are going to need long-term accommodation, and that sometimes is necessary. Again, it depends on the child. So again, with this, I just feel like there's some cautions that we need to have. And we kind of talked about these. But make sure that your accommodations have a clear goal purpose. You're not just doing them just because you have a reason for it and you're intentional about how you're doing it. And again, they become a hindrance if you don't fade them out. They should be your decision and not the student's. So this is a tricky thing. Sometimes when a student is recognizing that you are cutting it back a little bit for them, they can start to learn to manipulate that and be like, well, maybe if I go really slowly with this, she won't make me finish the rest of the page. Or they can, especially as they get older, they can learn to do that. And so I would say make sure that the accommodation is your decision and not the child's. Make sure that you are the one giving direction to it. Go ahead.
What do you do if they're manipulating their parents? But it didn't have it in my classroom
here. Could you explain more?
Well, she didn't do some certain thing, so the syllabus is too hard.
To the parents, and then parents are saying. Mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah.
The communication with parents is like, with like, there's triangulation or manipulation, like, as much communication directly from parent to teacher before the student talks about these things if possible. I know, yeah. It's, if you have a student coming to you that you know potentially has going to have some struggles, I would talk to parents very, very soon on and just maintain that communication. Again, I was hearing earlier in another session, we are servants of the parents and the school, and I don't know. It's a tricky thing to figure out. Anyone else have thoughts on that? Go ahead.
I found it helpful for a lot of these kinds of questions to think not in terms of what's easy or hard for the student, mm-hmm. but what will help them learn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Our goal is not to make things easy for students.
Right.
Our goal is to help them learn. I mean, if our goal were to make things easy, I can think of lots of ways to make stuff easier for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, for average or above average students, you know, like one of the things you mentioned a couple of slides ago, sometimes you have to lower standards. If we lower standards for average or good students, they're going to learn less.
Mm-hmm.
We should only be lowering standards, just to give one example, if it will help the student to learn more than
right.
they would otherwise.
Yes.
So that I found that really helpful. And in dealing with parents too, I think, you know, this takes a lot of sensitivity, but if you can foreground learning as opposed to other types of circumstances.
Okay. So is it helping them to learn?
Exactly. Yeah.
Thank you. And this is kind of connected. It's just being informed, informing parents of what we're doing and communicating with them, especially when it's a significant change. I don't think we need to communicate with parents with small little things, like I give them a timer on their desk to help them go faster today. But if it's something bigger, like we are changing how much that we're expecting them to learn, or we are changing the bigger changes, I think we definitely need to be in communication there. So, in your handouts, there are four case studies of four different situations, and I'm going to break you up into four groups, and I would like you to discuss, read the case study, and discuss among yourselves what ideas do you have to approach this situation. Now, I gave you another handout with a whole list of ideas of how to approach it. I would prefer that you don't look at that right now, and that you would, you have good ideas. I know that you do, so I would love to hear what those are. So, I'll split you down the middle, and let's do those of you on the floor, on the front here, to do case one. Those of you in the back three rows on that there to do case two. The back three rows over here to do case three. And those on the floor over here to do case number four. Go ahead and just knock them on yourself, and then we'll talk through them together in a little bit. Thank you. Sharpening his pencil, adjusting his seat, shooting baskets with his trash, chewing on his eraser, leaning back in his chair, or humming to himself, he is almost always in constant motion. During independent work, his restlessness is often evident that he is off task, something that is particularly true when his teacher is working with a small group of students at the classroom table. When this happens, the teacher is forced to repeatedly interrupt the small group to try to refocus Marcus on his independent work. How can this teacher better accommodate his needs? So, looking to you guys, what were your thoughts, or what were the things that you were considering?
Is this what that thing is for?
It would possibly be. This is, all I can tell you, this is called, you can call it different things, a wobble cushion, or I've called it a super sitter with my third graders. It is very kind of inconspicuous. Like, if you walk into a classroom, you don't actually see it. And when a student is sitting on this, they can wiggle and you don't actually, like, notice it. Like, you have to balance yourself when you're sitting on it. And so it takes some of that energy out in a positive way versus them falling off their chair or other things. Some students like them, some others, some don't. And I've actually, like, in my classroom, I have particular students that I would like to use it, but I offer it to anyone who would like to sit on it. That way it's kind of, it's not pinpointed as you have to sit on this. And it's kind of, some students really like it and some don't. So again, it's just an idea. But yes, that is one idea. What else do you have in mind? Or anyone, actually, as we look over this.
I think we had a lot more questions than we had answers.
Okay, so what were your questions?
Well, things like, is he being his own distraction? Or could he actually focus if he were in a place with fewer distractions? Mm-hmm. Because then possibly you're removing him from it, which is a less busy place would be helpful. But if he's his own distraction, he will not focus even in an empty room.
So it depends a lot on the environment of the class, maybe the structure of the classroom,
yeah.
And the environment. Like, is there valid reason that he's distracted, or is it something that, yeah. It's important when we think of, I think one of the first things to think about when we have students that are off task is, how is the structure in our classroom? How is it set up? How is our management going? Is that part of the reason why they don't know what's happening next? They're just kind of all over the place. Could we provide more structure there? Other ideas? Go ahead.
I had a student kind of like that. But what I often find with those students, they're the type that the life is kind of tense or something.
Mm-hmm.
I've given them those stress balls so they had something in their hands to play. I helped. But the one student that was right there, he was... You can never look him straight in the eye. He would tear up.
Okay.
He was like a nervous fault. Or always very tense.
Yeah.
And he always had to strap the whole class.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I had a student that sounded very much like that. He's also sensory from Boston disorder. But I found the situation, and I got an exercise rope, which kind of super stretchy, but I tied it on his chair.
Uh-huh.
And he would sit on that position and jump on the, it's going to be about 4 inches on the ground. He would jump on the rope and had a squeeze ball while he was riding his own. And that
did it work?
Did the trick.
Mm-hmm.
He would do it all three at once and then he would.
And so sometimes these things that we offer them can be a distraction. So we have to, if it is a distraction or making the problem worse, then we need to try something else. But in that case, yeah, I believe it. It's something about we need to keep moving. I mean, I've heard of a student that all they needed was a piece of string to push around on their desk, and they could, like, they were able to do so much better. They just need a positive way to get that energy out. I think, yeah, giving them appropriate ways to use their energy is important. Things like having the whole class get up in transition between classes and doing exercises, jumping, like, we do all sorts of exercises in my room between things. Jumping jacks and finger things and try to think of some, like, running in place and star jumps and, yeah, you can incorporate some movement rather than having them sit all day to try to give them a way to get their energy out. I would also with these students, go ahead. I'd also with these students think about our seating arrangement. So I've had students that kind of fit in this category and they needed to be in the back of the room because if they were in the front of the room, they had this audience behind them to watch them do whatever they were doing, and if I moved them to the back, they could still goof off back there, but it was not nearly a distraction to everyone else as much. But then some of the students, I want them up front so that I can, like, stay on top of them, so you have to figure out what works best.
Another thing I tried to mention is the chewing necklaces. Have you seen those?
Sorry?
They're chewing necklaces. They have a little hard thing on the end
they
just chew on.
Oh, wow.
And that also works.
Interesting. I have not actually seen that. Very interesting. All right, well, for sake of time, I think we'll go on to number two. It is the end of September, and your third grader, Megan, has failed the last two science quizzes as well as the chapter test and is quickly growing discouraged. She studied at home the night before, and you are puzzled because she seems to know the answers when you call on her in class. What could be a possible cause for her difficulty, and how can you help to bridge the gap? What ideas do you have back in the back? Or what questions did you have?
I see it as a possibility of reading comprehension, that maybe she's the text that was read to her,
mm-hmm.
and that she can comprehend better that way.
Mm-hmm. That's where I would go with it. Because we're thinking she knows the answers in class, she's comprehending the information, she knows the information. I would actually almost think of it as a reading fluency thing, because is she actually reading the test? So I've had a student, these case studies come from my classroom. I have the student like this who, yeah, he knew all the answers, and then when I read the test out loud to him, he could tell me all the answers and I could write them in, and he knew it all. So I knew the problem was that something with, there's a disconnect between what he knew in getting on the paper. And so I gradually worked with him and started having him read parts of it to me. So now you read the sentence and to walk, sit beside him and help him to read through it. Because, so in third grade is the first year that we had tests in science and history, and his reading fluency was weak. He didn't, reading was hard, and so he was not actually reading the test. It looked like, I'm just gonna go for it and put down answers and sort of read it, but not really read it. And so once I figured that out, then we could gradually work him up to doing it on his own. And then I had this little agreement with him, if there's a word that you don't know, raise your hand, I will come tell you what it is. And I gradually stepped him up to being able to do his test on his own. So we had to go back and start back and work up to that. Other thoughts on this one? There's also sometimes the writing could have been the problem as well, and output sometimes is really difficult for students. And again, go ahead.
The same thing, I had the same thing with the same child that I was doing with this. And he would freeze over tests.
Uh-huh.
And often before I would review most of the tests and the other hand and stuff, and just reassuring him that I knew that he could do it and stuff like that. Often,
so anxiety could be a problem here too.
Yeah.
And in this case, it could have been as well. And how do we help this child think about tests, that they're not so bad after all, and helping them, teaching them how to take the tests, how to think about different kinds of questions? Yeah, good. Anyone else? All right, number 3. It's early December, and you are growing increasingly frustrated with your 6th grade student, Alex. When called on in class, he usually knows the correct answers and seems to understand the concepts being taught. However, he has a terrible time getting his work completed. Most days, it is a struggle for him to complete 2 math problems, despite many reminders and prompts. However, every once in a while, he surprises you and completes the whole page. The inconsistencies are frustrating. What might be going on, and how might you support Alex? Ideas in the back.
Easily distracted, he might just not, like, if the noise or anything in the classroom the teacher teaching can be a distraction. Sometimes putting them in the final room or putting them toward the wall can change a lot. Or even having them go out into the other view, do things to help them to do that. Like going out with them being embarrassed that the rest of the students thought that they could ask me why he's always going out.
Not,
but still.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'm probably with the 6th grade boy like this. I say a couple of things, David. Sleep is probably where I would start looking at, because that's pretty effective, and also if he ate good breakfast. So just some simple questions with him can be a big help. And then this could be other issues, but I would maybe see a boy of this age maybe just talking to a little bit, especially with me as a man teacher, because there might be something going on at home that's consuming him, between his parents and his siblings, that he's not able to function quite well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you that there's something like a block, something like for some reason he can do it today and not tomorrow, and that doesn't make sense. I know this student that I'm thinking of in this case, and he was adopted, and I knew had experienced trauma and had some issues with anxiety, and so that definitely played into like needing to build trust with him. And considering that environment, there's something in here that is, he doesn't feel safe and supported. Like when he felt safe and supported, he's able to produce more.
That's sort of a question to go with this one, because I had a student almost exactly like that.
Uh-huh.
And she was old enough I could talk to her about it.
Uh-huh.
And I asked her, you know, what makes you be able to do 2 problems one day and then all of a sudden page the next day? And she didn't know.
Yeah.
And she was in grade 8. And I have questions to this day. I still don't know what made it flip one day. And she didn't know either.
Yeah. Would she have experienced trauma at all?
No.
Okay.
No. She can be a good one.
Yeah.
She has sort of been labeled, if you want to say, as ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure I should get into that now.
Yeah. Some students, like, school takes so much brain power that sometimes they just don't have it to put it out. Like, some students just work so hard, and
She was smart.
Okay.
And she knew her things and she'd get extra tests.
Okay.
And when it came to doing a whole page, so sometimes I would just cut it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Within reason.
Right.
And as long as she was trying hard. But she could get the problem or she could get the concept with just a few graphic problems where someone mm-hmm. just needed the whole page.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a place for that then? We can cut.
Mm-hmm. Like,
whatever.
So in that case, I would feel like if she knows the content, if she can ace the test, then there's no reason that she has to do every single problem. That's how I would feel about that.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else on this one? Okay, number 4. This is intended to be one student. I have a typo in there.
Kenton is a quiet, natured, respectful student with a very neat handwriting, great oral reading skills, and good spelling. He does well in math, except for the word problems, where he seems to guess which operation to use. After instructions are given to the class, Kenton often does something else, which is surprising considering his nature. He is not quick to answer questions, and when called upon to give an answer, sometimes his answers are way out in left field. What might be going on and how can you help?
What ideas do you have up here?
It's like he's struggling with reading comprehension or even almost short-term memory in some ways.
Mm-hmm. What makes you think of the short-term memory part?
Well, I had a student where the whole thing of like, so putting stuff in chronological order to read through, keep all of that information swirling around in his head and then put it in order was a struggle, or like multiple choice questions. So a math problem, you have to read all of it, keep it all in your head, organize it, and then put it out. Or just, so for answering questions, just, I don't know, remembering the question and processing them.
So something with the oral processing part and his comprehension.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulty with the word problems and giving answers that are off the wall, like way out there and completely incorrect, I would feel like is something with his reading comprehension and then his just oral language comprehension. So if you have a first grader, that maybe you need to break down what you are, the instructions that you are giving, so that he can actually like get it all and comprehend each piece of it. Other thoughts on this one? Go ahead.
Is his hearing okay? What makes me think that is, the instructions, not for him to answer questions, and then when he hears a question, it just totally makes it. I had a classmate like that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. How is his reading comprehension? It doesn't stay out there in reading class. He had oral reading.
I didn't
read very well oral comprehension.
That would be a great thing to consider. If you were working with a student, that would be a great thing to look into. Is it reading comprehension in math word problems, or is it... Does it overlap into reading class? That's a great... Yeah, this one isn't made up. I mean, I don't have it. But that would be a great thing to consider. And the hearing as well. Is there something like that that's in the way? So we're problem solvers, and you try one thing and that doesn't work, you try something else. And, when a student struggles with reading comprehension, I just like to point out that when they're struggling with reading comprehension, the problem is that they're not making pictures in their mind of what they're reading. So if I say to you, the dog ran up the hill, you have a picture in your mind, and your picture is different than someone else's. What does the dog look like? How big are they? What color? How steep is the hill? Where are they going? We all have different pictures, but some students that struggle with reading comprehension are not making those pictures in their mind. And even with a simple, if I say the word clown to you, you get a picture in your mind, hopefully, of what this looks like. okay? And are all different. And so there's a curriculum that's called visualizing and verbalizing, but the big idea is teaching them, you starting with small things and working up, so they can read a paragraph and they're visualizing it, they're picturing what's happening. So just a little thoughts there with that. I think for students like this, yeah, we need to use very clear and concise language and support them in how we break down tasks into smaller pieces. Any other thoughts on this one before we go on? Go ahead.
It seems like he's very particular with his writing. Maybe
yes.
He's concentrating so hard on his writing that he's not comprehending his writing.
You're saying when he's writing things down, he's not...
He's not thinking of what he wrote.
What he wrote down. Mm-hmm. And so then the writing is not making sense, maybe. I've had students that are too perfectionistic that is a problem. That's kind of separate from this. Someone else?
I assume exactly like this.
Okay.
And I'm pretty sure that a big part of his problem was that he did not understand things the same way that other people did. He was not able to enter any other way of thinking except his own. I'm pretty sure he was on the autism spectrum.
Okay.
Like if he'd read, you know, the dog ran up the hill, like you were saying, and if the question was, where was the dog running, then he would say, I have no idea where the dog was running. Was he running to the store? Was he running to the playground? It's like, how am I supposed to know? And it would not even occur to him. I mean, just to give an example,
right.
You're asking about the hill. You know, he could... And
so he wasn't visualizing it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly what you were saying. Yeah. And that would... manifests itself in all kinds of ways.
Yeah. Takes a lot of wisdom. But
talking about that same thing in different ways, mm-hmm. That's something I've thought about over the years. Well, I used to teach special ed, and something that really stuck out to me was to find that student's strength. Mm-hmm. So if a child is really struggling down, you know, like not getting up here, in our culture, our modern world, we set the bar here. I don't know what God's bar is for that student. Like, it might be completely different. Like, Einstein looked like a stupid person.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just keep that in mind. I think, and it helps them as students. If you can help them find something that they're good at, it helps them feel better as a person, too.
Yeah. Thank you. All right, we have just a few minutes left, and I would like to talk a little bit about the second handout that I gave to you. I hesitate to give this to you because every child is different. My goal with this is to give you ideas, a jumping board, springing board for when you are stuck with something else that I could try. And so I just want to show you a few of the things that I brought along as combinations. And this is kind of just a resource for you. For things that you could possibly do. So, thinking of students that have difficulty with focusing, something that's worked really well for me is to have little checklists like this. So sometimes we write it on the chalkboard, the things they need to do during seat work time. But sometimes students having it on their desk, where they cross it off when they're finished, is really helpful to keep students on track. They forget, what are they doing? You have to train them how to do this, but you need to look down here. You need to cross off what you've completed. And just having it, something about having it on their desk is, I found, really helpful. Rather than it's up on the board and I'm kind of don't know where I'm at on this list of things to do, and the teacher can go by and see what they have finished and what they haven't. It's one thing of helping them keep organized. If a student needs to be help motivated, things like put a good timer on their desk. I want you to be finished with your page before this is timer runs out. Or putting a little stuffed animal on their desk and he's watching you while you're working. I had a student I'd be so creative with how to get them, like, motivated to kind of build some creative play into it, and it's amazing how it, like, can help them. Some I've also, there's these things called punch cards that look like this that I've used for some students for motivation. When they complete their whole math page today, they get a punch in the corner. And when they, I talked with their mom, what's something pretty small that they would really like. And one student had a donut. Was what her mom was gonna get her a donut when she got this whole card filled out, which felt like a pretty a small reward for a big accomplishment, but it worked for her. Sometimes we have students that have difficulty with regulating themselves. And this would kind of be in the category of, like, the anxiety, the trauma, that piece of things, which would be on the very back. Autistic kind of sensory things. This, some students, their, like, motor is going so fast all the time. And this can help them to think about, how fast is your engine running today? Too slow would be like, I'm really tired and slow, and I'm, like, some students are in this zone a lot, as in they need to go faster, and they're kind of, like, laid back. Just right in the middle, and too fast is when they're, like, going super fast, and they need to slow down. So we want to be here in the middle. So helping students think about their engine is kind of like their motor. How fast is it going? And this is kind of a similar thing. I worked with a student who would throw these big, huge reactions to things that were very small. And we talked about what size is your problem, and your reaction to it should be equivalent to the size of the problem. And helping him to think about that. So if you get bumped by someone at recess, you should not throw yourself on the ground and throw a tantrum. You should, you know, it's just a very small thing. And if it's a huge problem, then it's okay to have a huge reaction. If you are seriously injured, that's something that's worth a bigger reaction than a tiny, than a small problem. Trying to think which ones of these I should talk about. How many of you have seen whisper phones like this? Okay. So sometimes students struggle with reading comprehension. Actually, sometimes I found that this could help, is that it, like, helps them to actually think about what they are reading. So if they, like, can whisper, if you whisper in here, it comes pretty loudly out of the top, and so you can hear yourself really well. So, or in a classroom where a student's struggling to stay focused, it could also be a possibility. Where I am, when I'm doing my work, I am whispering, reading to myself in here, and it helps me to, like, hear what's going on. So this one is homemade out of PVC pipe, and this one is a purchased one. The only problem with this is that it's loud and clunky on desks, but it does work. I think I'll just pull it to a close here. Do any of you have questions or things that you would like clarified yet? I would just like to point out, we are problem solvers, and we want to do everything that we can for our students. However, I will quote Matt Peachy from earlier this week, we are a servant, but we are not a savior. We cannot do it all, and so I would just, don't put too much pressure on yourself to do it all. Do what you can, but recognize that we're limited, and yeah, I would just do what you can, but leave the rest, let it go when you can't. I just hope that this has been helpful as we're thinking about how we work with our students, and I pray that you will have a good school year. So you are dismissed.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.